Hey, what's up, everybody? Simon Rentner here. Welcome to the Checkout podcast. You can subscribe to, also archived on our homepage at checkoutjazz.org. Produced at WBGO 88.3 FM in Newark. Right now, I feel like I'm wavering between two minds, feeling static, wallowing in a state of emotional despair, to swinging to the other side, ready to act positively, dreaming for a better future, hopefully. Whatever the case, my heart goes out to everyone peacefully demonstrating out there, wherever you are, on the streets or in your home. We've definitely had the chance for a little self-reflection, and our two guests today are a case study of putting some new thoughts to good use, and a case study of self-activation. As you'll hear, the saxophonist Tim Byrne and guitarist David Torn say they've never been so productive, and WBGO's Nate Chenin brings us that scoop. He's our guest host today, speaking to both the saxophonist and guitarist about all the awesome sounds they're creating today in the next hour. And a quick note, just forgive us if the audio is a little warbly. We recorded the conversation in Zoom, but don't worry, I assure you won't be disappointed. Thanks for checking in.
This is a track from Son of Goldfinger, an album released on ECM Records in 2019. It features Tim Byrne on saxophone, David Torn on guitar and effects, and Chess Smith on drums. And in this episode of The Checkout, guest hosted by me, Nate Chenin, we have David Torn and Tim Byrne from their respective homes. Gentlemen, for the last couple of months and change, some of us have been making sourdough. Some of us have been doing jigsaw puzzles. Some of us have been watching Tiger King. The two of you, among other things, have been making new music and releasing new music. And it strikes me that the productivity level is through the roof for both of you. So I wanted to start by asking, you know, at what point in home quarantine did you begin to feel that itch and say, all right, it's time to get really productive here?
Speaking for myself, I would say about 5 minutes in, I got very anxious and I said, great, free time. I mean, I didn't say great quarantine, but great free time. And so I just went nuts. I don't know why, but all of a sudden I realized I could work on things the way I used to in the 80s and 90s, and, you know, without fear of deadline. And then I just make up deadlines to motivate myself. And I like the guerrilla part of it. So I've always been, you know, since Screwgun and Empire, I've always been attracted to benign dictatorships versus working for others.
Is it the evaporation of touring and all that that really created that extra focus?
Yeah, I think so, because I spent so much time, you know, trying to get gigs on email, wasting a lot of time communicating with people, sending writers 18 times to the same people. It's a drag. And now that that's completely eliminated, and also the lack of pressure, you know, like, oh, I don't have to have this. This isn't for a tour. I can actually do this because I'm enjoying it. Writing things that don't have anything to do with anything, just to do it.
Tim, when he said he wanted to do his live solo record, he was just talking about initially his live solo record. And then he, within, it might have been within an hour or a day, he said, "Hey, what about your solo guitar record, dude?" And I said, "Which one?" And he said, "You know, don't you have like, don't you record at home all the time?" "Yeah, of course." So and that just kind of blossomed. I also have the same frustration with record companies. If I want to talk to somebody like ECM right now, number one, they never call me from the main offices in Germany. They just simply don't call. But if I call and I say I have a project, Manfred might say, "Cool, let's talk about the schedule in, you know, September of 2022," and then decide that at some point he might decide he wants to cancel that. So the idea of like just, okay, screw it, let's just put this stuff out. Let's just go. Why not? Why not have why not just do it? We both have pretty big back catalogs. Tim has a huge back catalog of material that is across periods of time and also groups, different groups of musicians. So Tim said, "You want to dive in?" I went, "Yeah, sure." And then since I'm working on like five other records at the same time, I suddenly was working on 9 records.
And duckies.
So before we go any further, I think I want to toss to that solo album that Tim made. And I was, you know, it's funny when you sort of sprung this on everyone, I stopped myself. I thought, could it be possible that this is actually the first solo saxophone album by Tim Byrne? So this is Sacred Vowels. Let's hear a little bit of a track called Rose Colored Acid from Sacred Vowels. Was made entirely in your house, right? This was made
third floor. During quarantine.
Tell us about the conditions of recording it, and then David, tell us about getting that music and producing it into this record.
Well, I've been talking about this. I like playing solo, but in the past years, I haven't done it at all, and I'm always afraid to work on it because if I start working on it and fail, it'll probably be the end, you know. So I was just kind of like, "Oh yeah, I got to do a solo concert. Oh, got a tour coming up. Can't do it now. You know, I have to work on this other music." And so that's what I mean by the free time. It was like something clicked that day when I called David. It was like, okay, now if I don't do it, I'm just lame.
You actually did. Your test bed was, you did these two little Instagram riffs that people immediately picked up on and went, "Oh, do you remember
the video
that?"
Video things, right?
Yeah, that kind of preceded, I think, really.
Yeah, that's true.
Fighting down, you know.
I started doing these little video clips. They're like 1 minute, and really with no thought. You know, I've been writing these solo-ish things for a year and a half, and you know, as I was writing them, I would play them and perform them for the phone, and make these weird abstract videos, trying to manipulate the phone myself and play. And people were responding. And then I thought, well, if I can trick myself into thinking I'm not making an album, maybe I can do this. And so literally I said to Sarah, my wife, I said, "Yeah, I'm gonna go upstairs and start and make this record." She said, "Okay, honey, you know, like whatever, I'll, you know, bring down some coffee." So I went up there and I recorded 4 songs. I threw my iPhone on the bed there was this blanket. This is our guest room that hasn't been used. And so there was this big blanket in the middle of the bed, and I just threw the phone on there, like a little pedestal, and stuck it on there and started playing. And I wasn't really consciously trying to aim towards the phone. I was just standing in the room where I liked the sound. And I did these little 3 to 5 minute things. I did four of them. These tunes memorized, so I was able to kind of just drift around. And then I thought, this is going pretty well, and I couldn't really listen back to them because I probably would have been traumatized. So I stopped after four because I needed food or coffee or something. And then I thought, oh, I'll just take a break and then I'll revisit it the next day. And I think I sent these to David and said, is this releasable?
Talked about microphone sounds and placement and reflections in the room and crap like that.
Exactly. Then I really got depressed. But so then I said, oh, then I sent one to Branford Marsalis, who I've become friends with, and we're exchanging texts. So I sent him one of them. He doesn't really hold back. Like that's why I sent it to him. I thought, okay, I'm going to get some great poop from him. So I said, do you think this sounds okay? I didn't ask him about the music because then I knew that would even be worse. But he says, dude, blah, 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 just listed these things. You know, too much room, blah, 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 move the phone closer, da, 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 you know. And then I talked to David and I sort of took the average of the two and thought, okay, I'm going to stand in a different position.
And he sent me one with room that I couldn't, that was really impossible to work with, I thought.
Yeah. Which is on the record. But anyway, I changed my position for like the last eight tunes, and I faced this short wall kind of. And then I remembered we did something on one of the Snake Oil records using a staircase for reverb. And so I faced the staircase thinking, oh, this is gonna be amazing. David will be really impressed. So I did that, and then I was probably, I don't know, 3 feet from the mic or the phone. And then I just ripped them off. I decided, okay, Torrin's gonna figure this out. I'm not gonna worry about the sound now. I'm just gonna get some good performances, because if I could tolerate it, I knew he could make it sound good after giving me like 97 qualifying remarks.
David, you've known Tim and his music for a really long time, and I wonder what your thoughts are, first of all, just about hearing him in this solo setting, what you think of the music itself, and then, you know, what you think of the finished product.
I don't know if I'm like other people, but I've been waiting for Tim to do a solo record for a while, and I would prefer, I'd also really would like to see him play some solo gigs, but you know, we're all different. We all do these things differently. So I was thrilled when he was doing it. And in fact, I liked the sound of the recordings. Tim at the beginning was thinking about getting a new kind of microphone or getting a real mic pre or something like that. So I didn't really think it was necessary, because at least half of my own shit at home is recorded on an iPad for speed, for the same reason he wanted it, which is, I don't want to think about being an engineer when I feel like playing. I love the material, and Tim's playing solo, and his tone is, and it's intimate, but not in a cheesy way. You know, you're there and there's his tone, and that's all I had to do was make sure that his tone was represented by recording on a crappy microphone. And it's not that difficult. Thank you.
thing that's liberating now, and again, I'm just talking about music, is I love limitations. I mean, limitations are very liberating. You know, you can't spend a lot of money, great. So you don't spend a lot of money. You know, like when we started doing Screw Gun, the whole concept was don't spend any money, you know, on recording it and then put it into the rest of the thing. And this is like an extreme version of that. You know, the whole thing of the label was, great, I'm back in that zone where I don't have a choice. So then I don't have to make any decisions. It's like, gotta record at home, gotta send it to David, and that's it. And do the, you know, I'm doing the covers on a $3.99 app on my phone. I love it. It's like, thank God, now a record, you can make the record, literally could be out tomorrow if David was awake and now working on something else. So, I mean, I love it. I mean, that part.
Yeah. You know? Well, as we talk about that kind of renegade spirit, it makes me think about one of the releases that you have coming out on June 5th, which goes, you know, pretty far back in your history to an early part of your collaboration with Hank Roberts, the cellist.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So this is an album called Cause and Reflect. And why don't we hear some of this music and then we'll talk about it. So this is a track from Cause and Reflect called Temporary Sanity. That was a taste of Temporary Sanity from the album Cause and Reflect, a new archival Tim Byrne recording featuring Hank Roberts. I'm Nate Chenin, and I am the guest host of The Checkout on WBGO. So, Tim, what year is this from, and where did it fall in your trajectory and in your relationship with Hank?
It was from 1998, and Hank and I, the first time we played together was 1977.
Wow.
With Kelvin Bell.
Oh, man.
In my Brooklyn loft.
Wow.
Julius sitting on the couch asleep while we were rehearsing. Slept through the whole thing. Woke up the minute we stopped. Yeah, so I've known Hank forever. And I think we started playing together in the early 80s, like doing gigs, which I used to have 3 or 4 gigs a year. So he was probably on at least 25% of them. And I think he was up in Ithaca, and I don't know, we were probably just talking on the phone. And he said, hey, you want to come up and do this record? And I said, yeah, sure. And so I went up to his house, and we went to this big room at Ithaca, or Cornell, I think, and just played, you know, acoustically, no headphones or anything. It's got some good baritone stuff, kind of more exposed, and acoustic, you know, really, really wide dynamic range.
Thank you.
Wayne Krantz introduced me to David. This must have been 95 or 6. It's when I was starting Screwgun. We knew each other, but he said, oh, yeah, David Torn, you should have him master it. It was this horrifying live recording. There was a ceiling fan next to the mic, you know, all this stuff.
Was this live?
Yeah, the Unwound record.
Yeah, the Unwound
record. I went out to David's thinking, oh, yeah, he'll listen to it for 5 minutes and go, this is unusable.
Thank you.
And so we go, and immediately it's like we've known each other for about 300 years. We're just talking, and David's like stopping things and making loops. He's going, wait a minute, dude, check this out. And then he can build this loop for about an hour. And I'm thinking, oh, at this rate, I'll be home in 2007.
And that's what happened.
So we go, this goes on until 5 a.m. And then I finally sleep on his couch. And then I remember really distinctly getting up, driving to this lake house where my sister was renting and went to the end of the dock, and it's like beautiful, 8 a.m. I haven't been asleep. I'm looking out and I'm like, what just happened? And I remember calling Sarah, who was still in Germany. You know, I was working with this guy, Torn. It was unbelievable, you know. And then, anyway, that's how it started, the whole Screwgun thing. And then I became an addict. You know, we've been working together ever since. And I still can't slip one by him where I try to get away with not mastering. You know, I even tried with a couple of these. I was like, yeah, don't worry, man. I think we're cool. You know, listen to it if you want, but don't worry about it. And then, of course, I begin, then we're mastering. I have a lo-fi side of my brain, and then I have this other side that, like, if this can be better, it has to be better.
You mentioned Steve Byram, too, the great graphic and visual designer. And, you know, we've had conversations with Steve and about Steve, and it really is this group of people who have a shared sensibility about the totality of the product. You know, like, Steve really gets inside the music too, you know, just as David does. And when I spend time with one of your recordings, I feel like I'm having an experience with David Torn and with Steve Byram, right, in addition to the musicians on the record. You know, it really distinctly feels that way.
It's an interesting thing. I mean, honestly, one would think that, especially given the history and the people involved and the additional people involved, we kind of brought this, not like a juggernaut, but this is what it is. Between me and Tim, this is a really long relationship and a long, long-standing productive relationship. This was brought into the ECM realm. Part of it got cut off. Steve's gone. Right, they're not using Steve's artwork, and in a way, I thought, I actually thought that this would become in some way a part of the new picture of ECM, and I think in many ways, I was kind of led to believe in some way that that would occur, but it's not what's occurred,
I think unknowingly,
especially now the circumstances have changed so much that we're here in this pandemical thing, and it's just not right to be kind of beholden to somebody else's schedule to put out the music that you want to put out. And
right.
And I know that this has always been the way, but I've never been that committed to making my own records in a regular way. I want to make them when I feel like making them. And in the last few years, that's really changed a lot. And I really feel good about producing all these records that I think are great. They have singular statements to them, you know. Or they each have singular presence in some way.
I also want to hear a bit of your incredible solo album that also was released at the beginning of May. And so let's hear a bit of that, and then I want to talk about that as well. So this is a, tell me how you would say the title. Is it Fur/Torn, or is it Fur Torn?
Well, it was just Fur, but when Tim put the slash and the torn in it, I think that I just call it Fur, but people say Fur Torn, and I like it too. It's fun.
Okay.
As a result of Tim's, you know, typical artistic way of putting something together, it just kind of stuck really nicely. You know, it looks good together.
This is a composition called Suede. It's the second track from the album, from Fur and or Fur / Torn. So let's hear some of Suede. That was a bit of Suede, and when we say Suede, it's S-W-A-Y-E-D. We're not talking about fabrics
here.
Oh,
right, that never even occurred to me.
From the solo David Torn album, Fur, and it's a really marvelous showcase. And I think it really puts me in the mindset of seeing you perform solo, and I think the most recent time I saw you might have been a couple of years ago in Beacon, at the Howland Center. I could be wrong about that, but that's one that I really distinctly remember. And you know, it's such a rich experience to hear you solo, you know, with what you're doing on the guitar and with all of your effects and, you know, using the room space as well. And I definitely got that feeling from this recording. And it also felt, and I think Tim will probably back me up on this, it also felt like something that's been germinating for a while and kind of needed to come out. So what are your reflections on Fur as a project?
No, I just so it's clear, these are really specific things that I do at home, and they are, and you know, as Tim was talking about limitations earlier and wanting to embrace them, And the same way that we discussed, not wanting to over-engineer things when I'm thinking about making the music myself, these things on this record are that. It's not my normal setup. It's only electric guitar, one amp, and between 2 and 5 pedals and no other electronics in all of the ones on this collection of them. Because some of these are, because I get in my room and I've got these really nice microphones, and sometimes I'm thinking about making taking a 1 minute video for Instagram, and so I'll just run my iPad, and I want to go fast. I don't want to, you know, before the dog starts barking at me, you know what I mean? Before it's time to make dinner, or I just want to get going and just focus. So they do have a different quality than a more direct quality, I think, and maybe more, even in spaciousness, they're more directly melodic, or they have more direct kind of songish movement to them than anything else I've done. Less longer spaces, you know. So and that's what they are. It's a collection of, maybe I make a joke about it, but I'm sure that there are at least 70 of these pieces I've done, because I do them, you know, I do at least a couple a week, and sometimes they're like 2 minutes long and sometimes they're 25 minutes long. When Tim said, "What about another solo record?" I thought, "Oh yeah."
the two solo albums that you each have produced during this time, they definitely feel like they are companions. But you've also mentioned, you know, so we've already talked about Cause and Reflect from the archives. There's another archival album. Well, I guess there's three more that are coming out on June 5th. There's a live recording by your band Broken Shadows, which is a group with a collective band that plays music by Dewey Redman and Ornette Coleman. And so where is this recording from? When and where?
Well, Nate, if I told you, I'd have to kill you. So let's just say it was recorded live, and it's music of Julius Hemphill, Dewey Redman, Charlie Hayden, and Ornette Coleman. It's raw as they come. It's like early Screw Gun raw. But the music, it's really, I mean, we did the studio record, which was really fun, and I really like it. But this is sort of us unleashed. And it was recorded live. I'll concede that.
We've already mentioned the collaboration with Hank Roberts. So we'll end here by talking about the third of those, which is...
It's a duet with Matt Mitchell.
Oh, I didn't even register that one. So there's another.
Yes.
Okay. So and this is a live recording?
Or? Yes, from 2010. Okay. It's one of our first gigs together.
Was this at Roulette?
It was at iBeam, and we were playing some of his music, some of mine. I think it was the first time we played duo for sure. And Craig Taborn opened for us solo.
Yeah.
That'll never happen again.
Tim, like all of us have had a conversation about the studio recording that you released on Screw Gun, featuring you and Matt, which is a really special collaboration. And okay, so that's coming out as well. What's that going to be called?
It just has a number one on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's really great. I really love that one.
Can't wait to hear that. But speaking of Matt, he is the thing that I remember most about this concert. So I guess the third or fourth of these albums releasing on June 5th, I can't keep the numbers straight, is Adobe Pro. So this is a live septet recording from 2009 at the Art Alliance in Philadelphia. It was an Ars Nova workshop production. I was there, and I have very fond memories. I was there, yeah.
Man, what a gig. Another one. Now that we're actually, I'm just going to interject here. It just strikes me, every one of them, I want to go, holy shit, have you heard that? The septet stuff is so killer. And the duet record, I'm just going to back out for a few minutes.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
if
so.
I'm afraid you can take it.
I have a lot of fond memories of that night in 2009, but the thing that sticks with me most is that was my first experience seeing Matt Mitchell. He performed solo piano first, like he played some of your music, Tim.
That's right.
Solo, and then came this septet. So let's hear some of that, and then we'll talk about that gig and about this larger sort of deluge of releases. So this is from Adobe Pro, Tim Burns Septet from 2009, and the track is called Spectacle. Thank you. You've been listening to Spectacle from an album called Adobe Pro by the Tim Burns Septet. It's a live recording from 2009. I'm Nate Chenin. I am guest hosting The Checkout on WBGO. And I'm here with Tim Burns and David Torn. Tim, that was a really good gig. You must remember it that way. what are your thoughts about this septet and sort of the specific qualities that it had? It feels pretty special, and it feels kind of distinct in your discography in a certain way.
Yeah, you know, it is. It's funny that the ensemble, you know, a lot of those guys had never played together. Matt and Dan Weiss had never played together. Dan and Formanek had never played together.
So this is bassist Michael Formanek, drummer Dan Weiss. Shane Ensley was on trumpet, right?
Yeah, Shane, I don't think he had ever played with Dan. He knew Matt. I'm not sure who Speed had played with other than me and Michael and Ducray. And then, you know, obviously Ducray had only played with Mike Formanek and Chris Speed. And anyway, there's a lot of first meetings. And the music that we played, it was a weird period. I had a couple of years where I didn't have a band after Science Friction, because I was kind of disillusioned with the whole thing. People get busy, then you never rehearse. And then I kind of lose interest because it doesn't develop. I can't bring in new music. And so I just kind of stopped and did a bunch of improv things. And then I met Matt, and I think the first time I played with Matt in my house, I asked him if he wanted to start a band together. I immediately saw, okay, this is it. He's young enough to not know that you don't need to rehearse. And and he'll obey orders for at least another month. So, and then I found Chess. I had some weird session with Chess and Mary Halverson. And I started writing this larger stuff, this septet stuff. I don't even know why, but I must have had a reason. There were all these tunes that I wasn't 100% sure they were, but there was a ton of music, and I played them with these guys, and they destroyed it. At the time, I think I wasn't sure all of it worked in my mind. I was still kind of working it out. And we did the gig, and then it was kind of like, well, I'll never be able to get these guys together again. So I just kind of moved on and didn't think about it until I found out the other day, as I was digging up live recordings, that Joe Brancefort, I had hired him to record that gig. So I was like, holy shit. And Joe sent me all these things, and I was just listening nonstop. I'm like, what the, you know, this is unbelievable. Why didn't I do this? You know, that's how it happened. And now I could kill myself for not realizing it at the time. You know, I don't know why I thought, oh, this is too dense. I can't, you know, I gotta fix this.
What a great density though, really.
Yeah.
As a listener, as a deep listener, and someone who really got under the hood of the recording, is there anything that strikes you about the music on this Adobe Pro album and this septet writing?
It feels like a big band to me, like a big, big band, much bigger than it is. It felt to me like, if I was making comparisons, it felt like a completely, utterly, densely psychotic version of something like the Science Friction band, you know, but big band and things that I've not heard before from Tim. so powerful. And Matt suffered through a crappy piano on that gig. And you wouldn't know that, I think, unless I said it, because I think that the nature of the music and what he's playing and how it all blends together and how well it was recorded, all everything becomes, that all becomes moot points you wouldn't speak about unless you were in some kind of technical analysis of things, which I'm not. Musically, power and difference. What else is different, Tim? Do you feel something different? Do you feel some connection to the science fiction period at all there?
No.
Sonically, but, none? No?
None. Zero. No, I don't know. Yeah, not really. I think...
Might be something to do with the power then.
You know, I hadn't written for a couple of years when I started writing these tunes. I know I wasn't writing much. And I was kind of avoiding the issue. I don't know what it is, but like some of the grooves and some of the vampier, those really long vamps. I don't know why at the time, I just thought I had overwritten this stuff. And I think it was also a struggle to play it sometimes. And so I would just get depressed because I'd bring it into these situations where there wasn't enough rehearsal. And then every time on the gig, we'd train wreck at some point because everyone's brains had just overloaded. And for some reason, this band had a big, lot of space in their brains, I guess. Shane and Dan and Ducrey, there was space and it was dense and there was space. It was weird.
Hear a science fiction connection, but I did hear a Blood Count connection because of Formanek and Speed. Then it's like looking back, you can hear a little germ of Snake Oil too, right? Because of
definitely a lot of those parts of those tunes are on the 25 Snake Oil records.
Yeah, so in a really beautiful way, it does feel like a document of transition. You know, like it has this like it sort of straddles these different eras. In your writing and band leading, it's a real like perfect moment in time, and it's also, you know, I guess I want to end on this note. It's also like several of these releases, it's a live recording. We're reaching a point now where I'm beginning to feel like an addict jonesing. You know, like just at a moment when, you know, live performance is the rarest commodity there is, it's really nice to get a taste of that.
For me, I've kind of realized I'm not going to do any gigs for another year, probably, at least. And I'm in this strange place where I don't see it as an impediment. Now I see it as this very interesting challenge, probably because I'm older than you are, for sure. Like most older musicians, you know, my heroes, blah, 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 they get to a point where they're, you know, probably just tired of creating stuff and they kind of ride it out. They sound great, but maybe they're not continually coming up with new things. And I always had this fear that I would become complacent at some point, or just I'd accept, okay, I did this stuff, whatever. It's probably cool. I can rest now. And all of a sudden I got this urge, like this panic to do stuff, you know, like, oh, I haven't done anything. And David, I'm going to force him to make a record every 2 months for the rest of his life. He doesn't know that yet. But we need that. The world needs that. And I like making records. I mean, it's sort of like making short films, you know, and you don't need money to do it now, in a way.
I see this as an immensely fruitful time. And important for me is that I don't enjoy making a lot of records, or I haven't in the past enjoyed making records too regularly. That's changed. And part of the change in that started for me more than 10 years ago when I built a SoundCloud page anonymously and just started putting shit up there. And that idea of like realizing when I joined Instagram, because one of my kids said, you know, you should do Instagram instead of so much Facebook because you like content, and so you can do, people on Instagram really like content, so just give some content. So that thing has just continued to snowball. And I see that I'm producing more than I've ever produced.
Well, I speak for a hearty bunch of listeners who welcome any new music by either of you. The more new and newly unearthed Tim Byrne music there is in the world, the better, as far as I'm concerned. And I want to hear more David Torn recordings as well. So Son of Goldfinger, that's a double win at a time when there's so much to be bummed out about. This is a real bright spot.
Thanks, Nate.
Right on, dude.
And you're listening to the latter half of Son of Goldfinger. That's David Torn, Tim Byrne, and Chez Smith on the opening track, iMetal, released in 2019. And guess what? They're coming out with another Son of Goldfinger, I think in July. So much music brought to us, hopefully making us all feel better, by Tim Byrne and David Torn. And I hope you enjoyed that conversation, and thank you to Nate Chenin for being our guest host on today's show. Follow him on Twitter. I know he's very active there. So are we at Checkout Jazz. That's our handle. The Checkout from WBGO also has a Facebook page, and you can find me on Instagram. Be safe, healthy. The Checkout is a production of WBGO Newark. I'm Simon Rentner. Thanks for checking us out.